the period of the flood, all the things that occur between chapter 6, 7, all through chapter 10. And then you have the scattering of the people. Where does that take place? What happened to the scattering of the people? Yep, in the plains of Shinar there in Genesis 11, you've got the languages divided, right? People said, come, let us make a name for ourselves, and they build this tower up into the heavens, and God comes down to see it, scatters the people, and then he makes a great name for Abraham in Genesis 12. So the rest of Genesis is Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Thank you, just making sure you're alive. And so that's Genesis. So if you can say those four periods, you've got a quick outline for the book of Genesis, which is, I think, kind of cool. 50 chapters. It's one of the longest books in the Bible. Before the flood, the sky, the people, the patriarchs. You got it, right? And Joanna, who are the patriarchs again? Abraham. And then who's the last one? And she's got it. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. All right, before we move on, how about we pause for a second, and we'll pray to God and ask for his help during this period. Father, thank you for this time of study. We're excited to open our Bibles together. There are a lot of really good things here that we need to know. We ask for your help. We ask for the help of your Spirit as you guide us and help us to see you more clearly. Help us to be humble as we come to your word. We want you to shape us. We want you to tell us who you are, who we are. Want you to tell us how you want us to live. These are ancient stories to a people long ago, but we see ourselves here. Help us to see Jesus and see your plan for your people today. It's in the name of Jesus we pray. Amen. In this period, we're in the book of Numbers. Now, the period of Exodus, of course, goes with what book of the Bible? Thank you. That was a softball pitch, home run. All right, so Exodus, the book of Exodus. And then wandering in the wilderness is going to be not Leviticus. Leviticus belongs to the book of Exodus because Leviticus, a lot of it takes place at Mount Sinai. Okay, so it's there that they're going to be building the tabernacle. They're there almost a year. And then they leave there, come to Kadesh Barnea. And that's in Numbers 11, 12, 13, 14. They come to Kadesh Barnea. And there they refuse to enter the land. And so God makes that generation wander in the wilderness for how many years, Amos? 40 years, yeah, 40 years. And during that period of 40 years, you've got the book of Numbers, the last two-thirds of it, and the book of Deuteronomy. Joshua is invasion and conquest. Then you've got the period of Judges, which is the book of Judges. And what other book happens during the period of the book of Judges? Or the period of Judges?
Ruth.
Yeah, Ruth. So you've got Judges, Ruth, United Kingdom, 1st, 2nd Samuel, part of 1st Kings, and then 1 Chronicles mostly. That's United Kingdom. So don't think all this is in order. We're skipping around in books a little bit. But you're just remembering, that's the story of three kings. And who are the three kings that make up the United Kingdom?
Saul, David, Solomon.
Yeah, a little slower.
Saul, David, and Solomon.
Saul, David, and Solomon, right? And that establishes the House of David, which is a huge cornerstone for the rest of the Bible story. But at some point, the kingdom divides. Some of the reasons the kingdom divides, what are some of the reasons? Idolatry is a big one. You could just summarize it and say sin, right? Or rebellion, or rejection of the house of David, right? Immorality, a lot of names you could put to that. But idolatry is really one of the major sicknesses during this period, the spiritual sicknesses. And so you have Israel to the north, capital city Samaria, and then you have Judah to the south with Jerusalem. Israel's taken away by what empire? Assyria. And then you've got the Babylonians who later come and take Judah away. They're in captivity. Some of the major players are in the captivity. You have Esther. No, I'm sorry, not Esther. Skip that. Not Esther. Let me ask the question to you. Who were some of the major characters during the captivity? Daniel? Mm-hmm. He's like, he's kind of the main guy, right? But maybe who are some other prophets? Jeremiah is going to be preaching some during the period of the captivity. We usually don't put him there, but he's kind of like in Judah alone and during the captivity. That's right. And Ezekiel. Ezekiel's kind of the major prophet during the captivity. He's actually prophesying from captivity, like Daniel. Daniel's in the courts with Nebuchadnezzar and the kings of Persia, whereas Ezekiel is with the people. And so you've got Daniel working with the rulers of Babylon, and Ezekiel's working with the people, the Jews, who are in captivity. When they return, you've got Esther there, but you also have Zerubbabel, who's not a book, but he's in the book of Ezra. and you've got Nehemiah. That's the return from captivity. And then a couple of prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. And then this period of silence where God is not recording any divine word. And so there may have been words from God. You're going to open up to the book of Luke and you'll see people like Simeon or Anna, and they're prophesying. So it's not maybe that there aren't prophets, but there's just nothing being recorded. There's no forward forward momentum in the story. Until you get to John the Baptist, you get the life of Christ, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Book of Acts is the early church, and then Romans through Revelation is just one easy big bucket to put all the rest of the New Testament in, okay? Those are all letters to Christians. So those are the 17 periods. Quick run through. We're in the book of Numbers, so we're wandering in the wilderness, okay? Are we good so far? This is all review, or overview as we put it, but that's where we are in the story. Now, I don't know why it took so long on review, because we've got a ton of material to cover today. What we want to look at, we're probably not going to do this, and I was working through, like, how far do we want to get today? I'd love to get through 31. I'm okay if we get through 27. That's fine. But we're going to look at chapter 26. Where we last left off, there were two characters, two fellows, who were working against Israel. Balaam and Balak. Which one is which?
Balak is the king.
Right.
And Balaam is the prophet.
Yeah, Balak king. And so Balaam is this prophet. He's speaking to Yahweh, but he's trying to find an opportunity to curse the people because he wants the reward that comes from that. And God says, these are my people. I'm going to bless these people. So you only say what I'm going to tell you to say. And Balaam fulfills that. And it seems like he even takes it upon himself just to kind of follow along with God's blessing the people in these final oracles. But we learn later from chapter 31 that Balaam was instrumental in getting the people to sin against God with what happened in chapter 25. Some of the women from Moab and Midian come down and they seduce the men and get them involved in idolatry. And the idea is that if God won't curse the people, well and good, but we can get him to curse the people if they sin. Because there are blessings for obedience. And what for disobedience?
Curses
for disobedience. That's going to be a major theme in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. So that's where we left off in 25. There's a plague that occurs. Then you see Phinehas with the javelin. Some exciting stories there. But that wraps up 25. What we do in 26 is in verse 2. The Lord tells Moses in verse 1 and Eleazar. Now, who's Eleazar?
Aaron.
Yeah, high priest. He's the son of Aaron. Where'd Aaron go? He died. All right, so just keep track of the story here, okay? Aaron's gone. He and Moses both had rebelled against God in the wilderness, and God said, Moses and Aaron, you can't go in. And so Aaron dies. Eleazar takes his place as high priest, and God tells him in verse 2, take a census from 20 years old and upward. Now, they had done this in the beginning. There were 603,550 Hebrew soldier men. There's probably a better way to say that. But now they're going to take a new census. And what they're going to find toward the end, if you'll look at Numbers 26, verse 63 through 65. Mike, are you there? Would you mind reading that?
These are those who were numbered by Moses and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel, the sons of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. But among these there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Zion. For the Lord had said to them, they shall surely die in the wilderness, and not a man was left of them, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun.
Yeah, and just saying with confidence, and we won't second guess you on it. So you've got the census that take place, and everyone who was supposed to die in the wilderness, save Moses, is now dead. Which means what?
They can enter
the land. We're getting ready to move on to invasion and conquest. This is an exciting time. You might think, well, that's exciting. Everyone died. But think about the new generation. There's this grief at what was lost because of sin. But now we get to move on and go into the land. And there's a fresh generation. And they have seen God's punishment and his wrath over rebellion and disobedience. So this generation should be thoroughly equipped. The oldest among them would remember the 10 plagues. Crossing of the Red Sea, Mount Sinai. the youngest among them would at least have seen some of what had just transpired with Baal of Peor. So this generation is probably going to be one of the most faithful generations in all Israel's history. So it's an exciting moment for them to realize we're getting ready to turn the page. We're getting ready to go into the Promised Land. God's judgment is complete. Can we go in? Lynn?
Is there any correlation between this and the fact that the chapter before, they just had this huge plague and thousands of people died? Is it possible that the rebellion of the people was still lingering and those were a lot of the people that died in that last plague? And now that they go ahead and count, like, that was kind of the last step.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying that the rebellion in 25 was probably instigated by some of this last generation?
Maybe instigated, or even just like it involved and the people that died off
were
part of that generation.
Yes.
Because now it seems so sudden to be like, well, now let's count the people and lo and behold.
Yes, I think there's definitely a correlation between the last plague and now God saying, Moses, why don't you go ahead and check the records? See where we are. And it turns out that had been one of the final purgings of that generation. So, if anything, it seems like God's kind of speeding up the process a little bit to get them ready to go into the land of promise. Now, other thoughts about that? I'm not going to skip over 26. There are a few cool things I want to look at here. But we're not going to take the time to read the whole thing, but any thoughts about just that last idea of getting ready to go in the promised land? All right, here are a few things to consider. I think this is kind of neat. I meant for those to come up one at a time, but they didn't, so there we go. In chapter 26, verse 8, most of these tribes, it's going to go through and list the tribe, and it's going to talk about some of the clans, and it's going to say how many there are and move on. But every now and then, it's going to pause and give you some details. And so picture it sort of like this smooth board, and then some splinters sticking up here and there, and you go, oh, what's that? There are these rough patches. And so when you see a text like this, and there's a pattern in the way things are delivered, but then there are some splinters, some rough patches, those details are intentional. So pick up on why those are there and what God wants us to learn from that. So in Numbers 26, talking about Reuben, there are two famous guys from the clan, the tribe of Reuben, Dathan and Abiram. And it goes ahead and mentions Korah here. With Dathan, Abiram, and Korah, what happened to these guys? That's right. Yeah, the earth opened up and swallowed them because... Yes, they had gone against Moses. They had rebelled against God. They had said, we want the leadership. Who do you think you are? All the people are holy. Said some really true things, but their heart was far from God. And so Moses said, look, if these guys die just in any ordinary way... then it's, just happened. But if something strange happens to them today, like, I don't know, the earth opening up and swallowing them, then you know that God is judging them. And then, and they all get swallowed alive, except for the sons of Korah. Now, if you go back, and we talked about this a little bit before, it says that all that belonged to Korah's household died. But here, there's a specific mention in verse 11, but the sons of Korah did not die. And those, now, by the way, Dathan and Abiram from the tribe of Reuben. Korah's from what tribe? Levi. He's of the sons of Kohath, which is the priestly clan. Levi has... The way clans work, and I'm a little confused by this sometimes because it doesn't always work this way, and we'll talk about it when we get down to the Gilead. But clans are the sons of Jacob. So 12 sons of Jacob, right? And you can cheat and say 13, kind of, because Joseph, remember, he has Ephraim and Manasseh. And they are taken, and Levi is not really counted as a tribe. So it just depends on how you're counting things. But you've got those sons. The next generation make up the clans. So wherever you have a son, Levi had three sons, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And so those are the clans of Levi. Korah is of the clan of Kohath, which is the priestly clan of the priestly tribe. So when you get to Korah... and his sons don't die. What we read about them later is that they write some of the Psalms. And it's really interesting to go back and read some of their perspective on God's character, on the history of the people. They have this heritage. We are the sons who did not die. Our father rebelled and we did not. And it's not a prideful thing. It's really saying we are a testament to what happens when you obey God, as well as what happens when you disobey God. And I imagine that each of us could probably pause and look at our heritage, your own individual heritage, and say, you know, I've got an opportunity here to do the same thing. I've got places in my life where I disobeyed God, or maybe I've got people in my life who disobeyed God, and I am where I am right now because of God's grace. And going forward, I can choose to be a testament to what God does with the obedient. And so the sons of Korah did not die. They instead write psalms, hymns, you know, these praises to God, these lessons for future generations about being obedient to the Lord. So that's kind of a cool thing that stands out here. This generational list is people who died, people who didn't die. Same thing with verse 19. Ur and Onan. Now it's been like a year almost since we talked about Ur and Onan. And by the way, Ur is like a candidate for one of the coolest names in the Bible, because if you forget him, you're just like, Ur. All right, but Ur and Onan, they are sons of Judah, right? And they die because... Do you remember why they died? You don't have to give me, like, the details here. They displeased the Lord. If you go back and look in Genesis 38, that was the situation with Judah and Tamar. Well, what happens is Ur dies, and then Onan, who's supposed to take Ur's wife and provide for her and provide an heir, he doesn't do it. He acts selfishly there. And then Shelah is supposed to take take Tamar, and Judah's like, maybe not. Let's wait till he's older, he says. And there's that whole situation where almost all of Judah's line is wiped out, which is really interesting, because Judah is going to be the tribe that leads to who? Jesus. And he's got these three sons. Ur's gone. Onan's gone. Why? Because of their disobedience, because of their hard-heartedness, their selfishness, their pride, right? And so Judah's starting to disappear. And only because of this woman here and her desire for a future that is kind of twisted and a little messed up, and all this is just, God's grace is really what shines through here, and God provides so that Judah doesn't just disappear. And therefore, we have a hope through God's promise through Judah. So Ur and Onan die, and there you see this reminder of they're going into the land of Canaan, where all the blessings of promise are. So Korah, Dathan, Abiram, they died in the wilderness. We'll get to go to the land of Canaan. There'll be no disobedience or death there, except you're going to a land where that did happen. So be on guard. Don't think that when we leave the wilderness, then we go to the land of promise, everything's going to be great. No, there's still going to be opportunity to be selfish and prideful and arrogant and go your own way, just like Ur and Onan. So be mindful of that. That's one of those splinters that seems to stick up here. Thoughts or questions about Ur and Onan and Tamar and all that?
They're also mentioned
in Genesis 46,
when they're talking about who went into Egypt, when they
went to
Egypt, and talking about how they didn't go,
what
did they die in?
Oh, yeah, so it talks about them, I thought about somebody they went to Egypt, I was like, wow, that's, but it talks about them as not going into Egypt. Right, yeah, exactly. So these men are remembered for their failure to receive God's promises because of their disobedience. Good. Now, verse 33, you've got Zelophehad, and we'll talk about him in just a moment with his daughters. He doesn't have, just through circumstance, I mean, he has no control over whether he has children or not, and whether they're male or female, is zero control over that. But he has daughters only. And the way the inheritance works is it's passed down through the sons. And so what are you going to do? And so it looks like this... poor Zelophehad. Yep, moving on. And so we'll come back to Zelophehad, but there's an interesting thing. With Gilead, I don't know what to make of this. I kind of do some work for me, somebody who likes looking into this. I'll warn you, Paul warns Timothy not to get lost in generational study. You know, make a big deal about generation. So don't go down a rabbit hole. But if you figure out what's going on with Manasseh, it looks to me like Manasseh has one son. Macher. But there are other times where it's like, I think maybe there's some other sons. I'm not quite sure. And some of the wording in 1 Chronicles 7 just, it trips me up a little bit. 1 Chronicles, the first several chapters, is going to go back and do a lot of review in the generations. But what it looks like is maybe because he only has one son, Well, you got one tribe, and how many clans would one tribe have with just one son? Just one clan. So Gilead becomes sort of like a tribe almost to himself, which is interesting because he comes from a tribe who has two tribes, Joseph, then you've got Manasseh and Ephraim, and then you've got Gilead, and Gilead becomes like a clan of clans. So if you look at verse 30, these are the sons of Gilead, of Jazer, the clan of the Jazerites, of Helek, the clan of the Helekites, and of Asriel, the clan of the Asrielites, and so forth. So you've got these sons of the son of, and it becomes the clans of the clan. Now, Gilead is going to become synonymous with the eastern side of the Jordan River. So the Gileadites, so there's a balm in Gilead, that whole area, the northeastern side, kind of parallel and south of the Sea of Galilee, that's going to be the land of Gilead. They're going to settle there, and we'll see why they do later in the book of Numbers. And then finally, again, generations, all these people, the census, and then again, these people who died because they did what was not pleasing to the Lord. Verse 61, Nadab and Abihu, remember they offered the incense, unauthorized fire, strange fire. God had not commanded it, and they died. So all these warnings, all these promises, all these reflections on what does it mean to be God's people? Just because you're born of Abraham, just because you're a child of promise, does not guarantee you get to go into the land. What matters here is how do you respond to the Lord? God's people, even in this oldest sort of collection of what it means to be God's people is really being marked by the people who are faithful to the covenant. Okay, it's not just, I've got Abraham's blood. It's, do you listen to the Lord? Do you respond to him in faithfulness? Okay. All right, thoughts, questions about this census? All right. I miss David because David Rafe would be like, yeah, the genealogies. And so he likes looking at these things. It's cool. All right, let's look at chapter 27. The first half of this is going to talk about Zelophehad, who's probably in the running for one of the coolest names in the Bible as well. But Zelophehad comes from Jacob, of course. Jacob's name is Israel. Joseph has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Trick question, who's the oldest one? I had to think about it. Manasseh is the older one. We always say Ephraim and Manasseh. Remember, Jacob blesses them with his arms crossed. And so Ephraim becomes the more prominent tribe. He's going to be the tribe that kind of leads the northern nation later in the kingdom divides. I'm throwing a lot at you. Okay, but you've got Manasseh. Manasseh has the son Machir. Again, it seems like just the one son. Machir has Gilead. And then Hefer is the father of Zelophehad. And then Zelophehad has no sons. But he's got some daughters. He has five daughters, Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And so these daughters come to Moses in verse 2, and they stand before Moses and Eleazar. And in verse 3, before the whole congregation, they say, our father died in the wilderness. He was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah. He died for his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be taken away from his clan because he had no son? Give to us a possession among our father's brothers. Now, this may not make so much sense unless you keep in mind what was said earlier in 26 in verses 52 through 56. The land is going to be divided up amongst the tribes by their clans. And so by name, lots are going to be cast. The size of your clan is going to determine how large of a portion of land. And if you don't have sons to inherit that land, you get no land. And if you get no land, it's like, where do you belong? It's almost like your name is taken out of the book of the roll of Israel. And these daughters of Zelophehad say, we want to belong to Israel. We want our inheritance. We want to be known as God's people. And we've got nothing to go on. No land is going to come to us. What do we do? Amos? About having children at all? About whether you have a son or daughter? Yeah, and that's a question that today we're like, what's the big deal? Like, just give the daughter the land. But in those days, there was an importance placed on the man taking care of passing down an inheritance. So you have Father Abraham, you have Father Jacob. Not really Mother Sarah or Mother Leah Rachel. And so it was this idea that showcases, let me put that differently, it was an idea that seems to represent the father is going to be over the family. Now, is that because God values men more than women? No. But it's leading us somewhere. I think the idea is that it's leading us back to the father is over the family. Not me over my family or you over your family, dads, but really, we're all under God. So we're responding to God as father. So it wasn't that sons are better than daughters, but it's this idea that sons are going to be representing God as leading his family. Right, right. Unless there's an Athaliah that gets in the way, right? Okay. Yeah, so, yes. So these five women, they see the importance of having a place in Israel. We need an inheritance. And Moses doesn't say, you're women, forget it. It's somebody walking down the hall, they heard that. What's going on over there? And he also doesn't say, oh, you know what, you're right. Let's take care of this right now. Instead, in verse 5, he brought their case before Yahweh. He said, God's got a plan for this. I'm sure that the father of the fatherless, the husband of the widows, I'm sure that the one who looked on Leah and saw that she was hated and provided for her is going to provide for you. And so he goes to the Lord, and the Lord in verse 6 responds to him in verse 7, the daughters of Zelophehad are right. And so he sees their assertiveness. He sees their desire, and he rewards that and provides that if a man has no sons, then his daughters become the heirs. Now, there's a kind of an addendum on this, and it's found later in chapter 36. But what's going to happen is the land goes to the daughters. What if you've got a daughter of Zelophehad, and they're of the tribe of Manasseh, the clan of Gilead, right? And they marry a man from Judah. Well, her land's going to go with him, right? And what's that going to do to the land that goes to the tribe of Manasseh? It's going to shrink it. And so the addendum is that if the land goes to one of the women, then she must marry of the tribe and of the clan of her father so that the land stays with that people. Why is that such a big deal? It ensures that God's people always have a place in his promises. That the people, they connected this idea, and God was doing this for them, that they had a place in God's special dwelling place. It was his promised land. And so it wasn't just about a piece of property, but it was about trusting in God's promises and wanting the blessing that he gives because of this covenant. And so God made arrangements for that. So we have this verse, chapter 27 and chapter 36, we're kind of bookending this section where we want to make sure 27 through 36, or we want to make sure that the future is provided for. There's some inheritance to be had. Okay? So why not just include 36 here? Well, it looks like it's working together as a package. 27 through 36 is going to be a lot about making sure we receive these promised blessings. All right. There's got to be some questions here. It's making sense? Is this good so far, Jordan? You good? It's good. All right. I think Amos raised a really good idea. Is why is such a difference between sons and daughters, men and women? Someone who's new to the Bible, or maybe they've read the Bible for a long time, and they look at this and they go, what is the big deal? How would you respond to this? Is there a difference between men and women? Should there be a difference between men and women?
Not necessarily.
You say not necessarily? Okay, in what way? Okay, so men and women are fellow heirs of God's promises, yes? 1 Peter 3 makes that point that a husband should be thoughtful about how he leads his wife because she's a fellow heir. In Galatians, we're told there's no longer slave or free, male and female. So in that way, value-wise, no difference. But you had a different thought.
Well, I was thinking during the time of Adam and Eve being in the garden of sin, I think that's where our curse came in. We were cursed to have our husbands take care of everything at that point. So
okay.
This just continue on from there. until we get to the New Testament and
we're going to see some tension in the marriage relationship because of sin. And I think Genesis 3, God says, you know, your desire will be for him, like to draw you after yourself. He shall rule over you. But even if you go back and look at Genesis 1 and 2, you'll see, especially in 2, and Paul makes a point of this in 1 Corinthians 11 and 14, that from creation, God intended that man would lead the wife. Adam names Eve. Adam's made first. Does that make him more valuable? No, but it gives him a different position. I mean, think about it this way. Jesus, is he more or less valuable than Joseph and Mary? Don't answer out loud, I'm just asking you to think about it. But is he in the same position as Joseph and Mary? He's not. And what Luke tells us is that, how does Jesus respond to Joseph and Mary? He submits to them. In Luke chapter 2, he's submitting to Joseph and Mary. Okay, so value-wise, we could see, well, position doesn't determine value. Okay, but there's a difference. And what the Bible is going to do is it's going to showcase this difference between men and women, different roles that are both valuable. And you get in a situation like this, and God doesn't just dig in his heels and say, but I've created the... He's showcasing a value of a different sort of thing. In this case, it's the inheritance. So anyone who's reading the Bible with open eyes is going to see that men and women are different, but they're also going to see a God who values them equally. And I think that's important to talk with our friends and neighbors, and, you know, co-workers about when we get to the Bible and they go, I don't know, men, women, isn't that kind of patriarchal hogwash? Well, it may sound like patriarchal hogwash until you start looking at it carefully. Don't start complaining about what's in the Bible until you've actually opened it up and start reading it. And other thoughts, Justin.
Yeah, I'm also kind of think it's interesting as like part of the church, we are essentially feminine in that regard, all of us, because Christ is the groom, right? So all of us submit to Christ in that way. So we actually all take on, at some points,
yes,
a male role because we're all equal heirs, right? And we also take on a female role as we submit. So
excellent.
It happens figuratively and literally.
Yeah, and I the first time I realized that, I remember thinking, that is so weird. I'm supposed to be a woman. And I can't tell you how many husbands I've talked to who'd never thought about it that way before. But it'll change your marriage. It'll change the way you respond to people who are in a different position than you are when you realize I'm in that position. And so I want to treat her in the way that I hope he treats me. And it changes things. And when you see women who submit with reverence, who submit with grace and meekness, it becomes something to imitate in the way that if she can do that to me, as sinful and as weak and as stupid as I am, then I can do that to Christ because he's wise and perfect and righteous. So, yeah, excellent. Amos. Yeah, Adam is the first created. Now, him leading his wife is not part of the curse, but the tension in the relationship is going to be there. But you do see when Satan gets at Adam and Eve, he doesn't go through Adam. He goes through Eve. And so there's... Satan knows how to drive a wedge between people by disrupting God's plans. He knows how to do that. All right, other thoughts or questions?
I will say, just for recognition, they do mention the mothers of the kings.
Yeah, they do.
So that is also, like, it's significant because you have the genealogy there, and just, like, with Mary,
right,
you get Mary's genealogy, you get Jesus from both sides,
yeah,
too. So
good.
There is acknowledgement, for sure.
And sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's negative. Like, you have a good king who has a bad son. It's like, where did it go wrong? Well, his mother was. And sometimes you have a bad king who has a good son. It's like, what? How did he turn out so well? Well, his mother was. And so you see the influence that women have. Yeah, excellent. All right, let's look at the second half of 27. In verse 15 through 17, Moses wants God to provide for the people. In 12 through 14, God had told him, you're going to go up on this mountain, and you're going to see the land that I'm going to give the people. But after you see it, you're going to die. And you will be gathered to your people just as Aaron was, because you rebelled. You didn't uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people in verse 14. And I don't begin to try to define in my mind what I think Moses must have been feeling there. Moses was raised for a little while by his mother, his Hebrew mother. I think being taught by her, understanding something of his heritage. But he's raised in the house of Pharaoh, the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He gets old enough to see his people in bondage and they're under this oppression. He wants to deliver them. He gives up on that dream, apparently, when they reject him. Flees, and he's gone for 40 years. God finally cracks through. Moses is thinking, I'm not the guy. That's done. I've been there, done that, tried it, didn't work. And that's a dream he's just given up on. And God says, no, come back. And you see him softening through the plagues. You see something happening to Moses. He's being more bold as time goes on. And so he comes out and delivers the people. They cross through the Red Sea. 1 Corinthians 10 makes the point that they're baptized into Moses. He becomes the leader. He's the chosen savior of the people. And he wants to finish it. He's not only helped them to establish this relationship and this covenant at Mount Sinai with God, but to restore it after the golden calf. I mean, he cares so much for these people. And he gets to this moment and he can't go any further. He can get all the way up to the brink, and he has to stop. And when I was younger, I thought, poor Moses. He's done all that work, and he doesn't get to go in. But I don't think that's what Moses is concerned about here. What he wants is someone to go with the people. It wasn't that he got up to the brink and couldn't go in. It was that he got up to the brink and couldn't take the people in. Because he wanted them to have a leader. He wanted them to be provided for. And so you see him asking for someone who would be over the congregation, who would go out before them, come in before them. That's military language. Okay, it's going to be used later to talk about David. When Saul's king, and they're looking at David, they're like, well, David was the one who went out and came in, went out. Like, he's the guy. Moses is kind of like this military leader. He's like, they're going to go into battle. I need God. They need somebody. And they need a shepherd. And if they're sheep without a shepherd, what happens? They all go astray. They scatter, right? Sheep without a shepherd scatter. And so Moses is looking at the people like, it's hard enough keeping them together. They need somebody. And so God is going to appoint a leader. And he tells him in 18 through 21, I want you to take Joshua. And he's going to stand before Eliezer. He's the man in whom is the Spirit. I think that's interesting in verse 18. The Spirit. I don't understand all that means. But God's working through Joshua. He's working with Joshua. By the way, have we seen God's Spirit through this point already? Like, where have we seen God's Spirit working in the Bible story up to this point? Jordan? Definitely with Moses, right? And when Jethro comes and helps him to realize, like, you need some help, and God has him appoint other leaders, the Spirit comes on them for a time, and they're helping to lead the people. How else? When else?
Earlier, there were chiefs that the Lord's Spirit came upon them. They were prophesying.
Yep, kind of the same occasion, right? But you see prophecy happening in that moment. What about when they're building the tabernacle? Do you remember anything happening there? Tabernacle? Spirit of the Lord?
The Spirit comes on the tabernacle after they built it?
Spirit comes in the tabernacle, but also when they're building the tabernacle. Aholiab and Bezalel. Remember, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon these guys. And you could go all the way back to the beginning if you wanted to and say Genesis 1. The Spirit's active in creation. But you've got this intimate interaction God's having with people who are leading and building and guiding, and he's part of this. And so in Joshua is something of the presence of God. And I don't understand how all that works at this point, but the Spirit is working in Joshua, and he's given authority over the people. He's going to guide them, the Urim and Thummim. So if Joshua needs to know what's what, this is going to be important later. Bookmark this in your mind, if you will, however you do that. Like, I don't know if you guys do that. But, like, remember, Joshua has the opportunity, whenever he's got a question about something,
You know, like, I'm not sure if this is a good idea or not, God. Hint, hint. He can go and ask Eliezer and be like, could we consult God, Urim and Thummim? And he, yes, absolutely. Let's go, Joshua. And so he needs to check in with God. But he's going to be leading the people. All right. Joshua's the guy. This is going to be this transition where Moses is going to stand before the people, stand with Eliezer. Eliezer is going to appoint Joshua, lay hands on Joshua. He's going to become the new Moses. Okay, he's the new leader of the people. I see in this some things that are relevant today. What do you see? When you're looking at this list of criteria for the leader God's chosen, I see some things that are relevant. What do you see? Do you think there's anything in this about maybe how we should lead people? And back to male, female, even as females, opportunities to lead people? Yeah. About leading children. What about older women teaching the younger women? Right? There's opportunity to lead, to influence. What does it take to be the kind of leader God wants a leader to be? We saw Korah, Dathan, Abiram. That didn't. No. But here we see Joshua, and God says, that's the guy. We need the Spirit influencing us. We need the truth of God coursing through our lives. Amos?
Part of it is trust. There are people that believe that somewhere earlier, it talks about Joshua as a high priest.
Not as a high... Oh! You know, we were in a study of Zechariah yesterday. That's Joshua the high priest in Zechariah. Different Joshua. But a very cool picture that could connect here. But that's a different Joshua. But trusting God, Joshua and Caleb both trusted God when no one else did. So to be a good leader of God's people, you're going to have to trust God. I mean, that's too much for one person to lead these people. That would crush Joshua unless he's following. Good leaders are good followers. They know who to follow. Amen?
To maintain his position or hold on to it as long as possible, or even just say, well, nobody could do as good of a job as I did. Tough luck. Like, he's looking out for the best of the people, and he's ready to pass on to someone else and lift them up in the eyes of the people and help set him up for success to be a leader.
I've often thought of this passage with regard to a dad giving his daughter away in marriage. I've not... had to do that yet, but someone's done that to me, and I thought, like, how am I going to lead this lady? I mean, she had a good dad, and now she's following me, and he had to have some trust, you know, for this next generation, knowing there are going to be mistakes made, knowing there's going to be a learning curve, but that's just part of it. All right, what else?
I think this thing from here that no one is going to have a relationship with God like God is going to progressively distance himself more from the leadership and then ultimately the people.
Yes. You're going to see, I mean, might say David, but David doesn't speak to God face to face. We're going to see that need later in Deuteronomy for sure, where God, in chapter 18, Deuteronomy 18, promises that someone's going to come like Moses. We need someone like that. Yeah. And I think this list points to that someone. The Greek name for Joshua?
Jesus.
Okay, Yeshua, right? Is Jesus a man in whom is the Spirit? Yeah. And he's baptized, right? The Spirit descends upon him. He returns in the power of the Spirit. You know, chosen before the priest. I think this is kind of interesting. There are a number of areas you could take this, but... that week before Jesus' crucifixion, what are the elders and scribes and Pharisees and Sadducees and priests trying to do to Jesus? You know, everything they're doing is indicating that Jesus is the one. Okay? And it's in the sight of all the people. Later in Acts 2, Peter's going to say, look, he did all these signs and miracles in front of everybody. Everybody saw all these things. A man that God had tested before all of you. He's certainly given authority. He guides by God's direction. I mean, just so many things that connect. So I think Alex is dead on. We see something here about who we should be as leaders. But if we stop there, then the standard of leadership is Joshua. But move on to Jesus, and you see that the standard of leadership isn't Joshua, it's Jesus. And not only do we see something to imitate, but we see someone to follow. Jesus is our leader. We're the sheep who need a shepherd. Jesus becomes that for us. All right. Good, Mike? All right. Thoughts, questions through 27. I knew myself too well. I thought, 31. We'll get through chapter 31. Now I'll be happy through 27. All right, we got through 27. What we're going to do next time is we'll finish looking at the entire book of... No, I'm sorry. Not the entire book of Numbers. We'll look at 28 through 31. So if you want to be reading ahead, 28, 29, 30, and 31. And be considering what... Remember, 27 through 36, I'm pretty sure these two stories wrap together, looking at the daughters of Zelophehad. They're looking forward to the promise of God, the fulfillment of the promise of God. That's why these two things are separated that way. And so... be thinking about through this, not just, okay, I know the offerings and the instructions about the offerings and vows, but be thinking about how does this connect to God fulfilling his promise, and see if you can make any sense of that. We'll go ahead and take about a 10-minute break, and we'll get ready for worship about 11 o'clock. Thanks, everybody.